Good evening and welcome to the KRFP Evening Report for Monday, November 11th, 2024. I'm Lee Robartis in the news tonight. Anti-Trump protest at the University of Idaho walkout. Washington, one of the few states where Trump did worse in 2024 than in 2020. Democrat Glusenkamp Perez on track to win Washington's third congressional district, a district that flipped 2 years ago. Childhood sexual abuse survivor Natalie Greenfield of Moscow reveals her mother facilitated the abuse and collaborated with Christchurch pastor Doug Wilson in dealing with the fallout. Well, details on those stories and more coming up on the KRFP Evening Report. And live in the KRFP studios in Moscow, Idaho, I'm Lee Robartis, and this is the KRFP Evening Report. Washington was one of a very few states that former President Trump lost ground in during this year's election compared to 2020, likely making the Evergreen State a target of Trump's retribution, a pattern that was evident in the first Trump presidency. Overall, Washington Democrats solidified their control over Washington's politics, and the repudiation of the right-wing ballot initiative to repeal the state's landmark Climate Commitment Act was another indication of the political landscape in the state turning more blue. County results in the presidential show Trump improved somewhat in eastern Washington, but that was eclipsed by how much ground he lost in the densely populated western Washington. With control of the House still up in the air, Democratic Representative Marie Glusenkamp Perez is leading in the race for Washington's 3rd Congressional District in the Vancouver area by a margin of 3% against MAGA Republican Joe Kent. Glusenkamp Perez flipped the district to blue 2 years ago, winning over Kent. The pair had won the top two primary in 2022, ousting Republican incumbent Jamie Herrera Butler, who was targeted because she was one of a very few Republicans who voted to impeach Trump in 2021. It's likely this year's margin of victory for Glusenkamp Perez will be much larger than her 0.7% win over Kent in 2022. In the 8th Congressional District, which straddles both sides of the Cascades between Seattle suburbs and Wenatchee, Democratic incumbent Kim Schreier was leading Republican challenger Carmen Goers by about 7.7%, which improved on Schreier's margin of victory in 2022. Schreier flipped the district in 2018, which was a year Democrats benefited from backlash against the Trump presidency. The Idaho Department of Transportation has announced the 6-mile section of U.S. Highway 95 immediately south of Moscow will not open to traffic until the end of next year. The current 2-lane U.S. Highway 95 will remain the main route between Moscow and Lewiston. The ITD claims the new route at a higher elevation on the flank of Paradise Ridge will improve safety, although critics say the high incidence of ice fog at that location plus higher winds will make the new route more dangerous. Advocates for the new highway route have claimed environmentalists have blood on their hands because of the 10-year delay in starting the project caused by the ITD looking for researchers who would support their route during the environmental impact statement process. However, the Paradise Ridge Defense Coalition and others have called for the ITD to reduce the speed limit on the narrow section of Reisenauer Hill south of Moscow while the routing made its way through the courts, but the Transportation Department has refused to do so. The ITD has imposed 45-mile-per-hour speed limits on parts of U.S. Highway 95 near the construction zones where the new section of highway is expected to connect. The Idaho Transportation Department issued a statement last week which says, while crews have constructed 4.8 miles of the new 6-mile highway project, including two large bridges over Ede Road since work began in 2022, wetland bridge and retaining wall work is needed on the south end, while pavement construction is planned on both connections next year.
A proposition on the ballot to change the way voting works in Idaho failed in last week's election. Proposition 1 would have opened up primaries to create a top four system and ranked choice voting in general elections. The measure received 30% approval. Al Vanderclip with the Northwest-based think tank Sightline Institute says even when people dislike the status quo for elections, they are suspicious of proposals to change the way they vote.
The default stance of most voters is no for these ballot measures, and so there's a really high bar to educate voters on the potential benefit of why they might want to vote yes. And in this case, it appears that bar was not cleared.
Many top Republicans came out in opposition to the measure. Like many states across the country, state Republicans saw success on Election Day, adding three more seats in the state legislature to the supermajority they already possessed. A ranked choice measure in Oregon also failed. However, Vanderclip notes that candidates could win without receiving a majority of the votes.
Let's say the independent candidate wins 33% of the vote, and the Republican wins 33% of the vote, and the Democrat wins 34. That would elect a Democrat in a state that really doesn't elect Democratic candidates, and that would not be representative, probably, of the population as a whole.
Vanderclip notes that a ranked choice system could solve this by counting people's second choice in elections. But with an unpopular result for Proposition 1, he says other changes could be possible in the future.
There are more incremental reforms like top two primaries rather than top four. California and Washington use those. They're pretty popular. They're effective in electing more moderate and more representative candidates.
Vanderclip adds that ranked choice voting could be passed at the local level so that voters can try it there first and become familiar with the process. Support for this reporting was provided by the Carnegie Corporation of New York. For Northern Rockies News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
About 50 University of Idaho students participated in a walkout in front of the library Friday in protest of the ascendancy of Donald Trump. About 100 passersby stopped and listened. The protest also attracted supporters of the right-wing president-elect, who used amplified music to try to drown out or distract from the walkout protest. Here's some excerpts from the protest rally, starting with Drew Mattai on the failures of the Democratic Party, followed by a protester reading a statement sent by Universalist Pastor Elizabeth Stevens of Moscow, who could not attend the rally in person.
I think you will see that there's a lot of messaging and efforts to blame some particular group of people or political formations, whether it's black men or Latinos or suburban women, or the stupidity of the American public, but the blame falls on one group firmly and almost wholly. And that is the Democratic Party. They ran a weak candidate with Harris, basically installed unilaterally by the party leadership, ignoring the demand of their constituents for an actual primary in a supposedly crucial election, immediately after they tried to foist upon us the alarmingly senile Biden by shunting their own primary, gaslighting us the whole time, telling us that our own eyes deceive us as to his senility right up until they removed him themselves. This is the latest, and hopefully the last in a humiliating saga of the Democratic Party using us as tools for their own ends, and then abandoning every shred of initiative as soon as they are comfortably in power. People want change. We know it did not have to be Trump's offer of brash, violent destruction. It could have been Bernie's. It could have been a brighter, more cooperative future. I won't try to make any claims about he will magically come back, but we have to learn from our past. Who defeated Bernie? Who torpedoed his campaign despite his widespread popularity? It wasn't the Republicans. It was the Democratic Party, who are beholden, no mistake, to the corporate masters and no one else at all.
Abortion bans are killing people and making childbirth infinitely more dangerous across the board. Here in Idaho, we've lost 22% of our OBGYN doctors and 55% of our high-risk OBs. Three maternity wards have closed. And I know I've said this before, but I'm going to keep saying it over and over again until everyone is fully aware of the consequences of overturning Roe v. Wade. We at Fans Off Moscow will keep fighting on, whether we win or not, because abortion rights are human rights. Abortion bans are killing people and making childbirth infinitely more dangerous across the board. Here in Idaho, we've lost 22% of our OBGYN doctors and 55% of our high-risk OBs. Three maternity wards have closed. And I know I've said this before, but I'm going to keep saying it over and over again until everyone is fully aware of the consequences of overturning Roe v. Wade. We at Fans Off Moscow will keep fighting on, whether we win or not, because abortion rights are human rights.
But the last few days have been very scary. As a queer person, I've doubted my future. I've wanted to stay hiding inside. The future might be scary.
That was some of the sounds from the University of Idaho anti-Trump rally and walkout held Friday afternoon in front of the UI library in Moscow.
Programming on KRFP is brought to you in part by One World Cafe, specializing in craft coffee, fresh baked pastries, artisan sandwiches, weekend brunch, wine, beer, and cider on tap. One World Cafe has a web calendar for upcoming live events and a campus location in the Janssen Engineering Building.
KRFP is dedicated to progressive values, including peace and human rights.
A champion of rights for older LGBTQ plus folks has received recognition for her volunteer work in Oregon. Liz James is the winner of the 2024 AARP Andrus Award for Community Service, thanks to her engagement in a number of efforts to improve the health and equity of LGBTQ plus people in the state. She says volunteering is a vital part of her life.
Volunteering gives me purpose, social connection, opportunities to learn and grow, and to make a difference.
James lives in Southern Oregon. She's the chair of the Oregon LGBTQ plus Aging Coalition, chair of the Rogue Valley Council of Government's Joint Senior Advisory Council, and a volunteer with AARP Oregon. James stresses that LGBTQ plus folks are not a monolith, and they exist in every community. She says they're not a single community, but many communities. But she does note that there are specific health risks and needs for people who are LGBTQ+, and that discrimination does still affect their living conditions. She adds poverty and suicidal ideation are higher for them.
Data shows we're twice as likely to be single and living alone. We're more likely to be estranged from family. We're half as likely to have a relative to call. We're four times less likely to have children, and almost 1.5 times more likely to be primary caregivers.
James was also instrumental in passing Senate Bill 99, which established the Bill of Rights in long-term and community-based care facilities for LGBTQIA2S+ residents and residents living with HIV.
First of all, it prescribed very specific non-discrimination protections that have to be physically posted and provided to all residents and adhered to, and there is accountability for violations built into it.
She notes that the bill also requires training for staff in long-term care facilities. James is serving on the LGBTQIA2S+ subcommittee of the Governor's Commission on Senior Services, which was established by Senate Bill 99 and started this year. For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Montana citizens and environmental advocates have sued the state for withholding documents that have, for decades, been considered public information. The division that provides bill drafting and other support to the Montana legislature has announced a new policy that requires a legislator's approval before releasing documents to the public. That includes all the correspondence and communication that goes into drafting a bill, including lawmakers conferring with lobbyists and other legislators. Upper Seven Law's Riley Summers Flanagan says Montana's Constitution protects residents' right to know about and participate in the legislative process.
The right to know is meant to protect our ability to examine the documents of any public agency. This includes all executive branch agencies. It includes all aspects of the legislature. Anything that relates to their official business belongs to the people of Montana.
A Helena judge over the summer ruled that correspondence used to draft bills, so-called junk files, are not public record, reversing a 25-year-old policy. Summers Flanagan argues the move undermines transparency, which she says has been the backbone of Montana's lawmaking process, and calls into question interactions between lawmakers and lobbyists, who often work together to create a bill.
We could literally be deprived of an opportunity to see bribery happening in writing. I doubt that our legislators are engaged in bribery, but what this does is it protects them fully from any sort of disclosure around what they might be exchanging.
The rule was implemented when a district court ruled in favor of a state senator who argued that junk files related to a gerrymandering law should not be made public. I'm Mark Moran for Big Sky Connection.
And you're listening to the KRFP Evening Report. This is KRFP Moscow Pullman. Natalie Greenfield, who has openly spoken of the childhood sexual abuse she went through for a number of years while living with her family in a large house in Moscow, where a number of new St. Andrews students were boarders, has come out with new realizations in a Facebook post saying her mother was complicit in allowing the relationship between her when she was 14 and a 24-year-old student to move forward. New St. Andrews College is under the domain of Christ Church and Christ Church pastor Doug Wilson. In a speech by Greenfield to the secularists of the Palouse in 2016, Greenfield had told of her relationship starting when she was 14 years old with a 24-year-old student at New St. Andrews Greyfriars Institute, which is the division of the college which tries to train priests. After Greenfield's parents found out about the relationship, Greenfield spoke of how Pastor Doug Wilson met with her parents and had later written to the judge in the case calling for consideration of a measured sentence. Now Greenfield has posted on Facebook saying her mother was complicit in allowing the relationship to happen. Here's an extended excerpt of Breaking the Silence, My Story Unprotected from Angel Rose, recently posted. My name is Angel Greenfield, and I'm here to set the record straight. If you're familiar with my childhood story of abuse, I went by my legal name, Natalie Greenfield. Some of what you're about to read will feel familiar. The difference is that, for the first time in my life, I'm sharing my story without attempting to protect anyone. This doesn't come from a place of anger, vengeance, or resentment. It's born from the realization that, though I have told my story far and wide, I've always hidden a truth that I couldn't bear to hold. Time changes us, and as I have grown, so has my capacity to sit with difficult truths I once found impossible to confront. It has been 25 years since my abusive relationship with an older man began, carefully fostered under circumstances I could not then understand. For a quarter of a century, I have tried to comprehend the insanity that took over my life. Over the years, realizations have come in pieces, and I have responded as best as I could manage. A few years ago, I made a public apology to Doug Wilson. That apology was sincere, though deeply misunderstood. In the apology, I explained that I had placed blame on him, which belonged on others, and I stepped away from the fight I'd been engaged in for over a decade. I had begun to understand more about what really unfolded when I was a young girl, but I still wasn't ready to talk about it in public. My stepping away from advocacy then may have appeared to be a retreat, but it was necessary for me. I had more truths to sit with, and even now the weight I couldn't bear has only grown heavier, crushing, leaving me with no option but to release it. After my public apology, my advocacy never truly ended. Behind closed doors, I have been in an ongoing painful conversation with myself and a few close confidants, trying to find understanding and truth in the mess of my past. Slowly, I've chipped away at old beliefs and fears to uncover what lay beneath, a particular relationship whose importance overshadowed my own well-being and kept me silent. For years, I hoped that if I fled from the truth long enough, it would reveal and resolve itself without my intervention, and that, along with it, the burden that has weighed me down might dissolve. I've asked myself countless times, why can't you just talk about this? The answer was always tangled, often centering on how sharing the truth might hurt the people I loved, or how I needed more time to process, or more details. I even imagined writing a book much later in life, maybe once everyone involved had passed on. Deep down, I knew this was just another way to evade reality, to avoid confronting the truth, and with each passing day, the truth became heavier, pressing down until my very cells begged me to let go. When my father died last March, my world shifted. I spent 7 months living in his home and caring for him, watching cancer ravage his body and witnessing his fight to avoid facing the truth of his illness. It was devastating. It showed me how illusions can rob us of precious moments, even at the end of life. I began to examine my own illusions to ask myself what truths I was too afraid to face. What was I missing for the sake of clinging to falsehoods? How long would I keep holding onto a burden that was only mine to release. I told myself the truth would hurt too many people, that it was somehow noble to remain silent. But in reality, I was suffering. I had convinced myself I was being the bigger person in the truth. I was afraid of what would happen if I spoke up. I feared losing relationships, being unloved, disliked, or misunderstood. But the contrast provided to me by those who have shown me unconditional love eventually made it impossible for me to keep up the facade. My tolerance for inauthenticity has dwindled, especially in the last year, and my desire for complete freedom from manipulative relationships has steadily grown. Slowly, I saw where I was living out of alignment and maintaining a lie that had never once served me. The path forward became clearer as I untangled the complex knots inside my head and heart. I had always known this path existed. I just hadn't believed I could walk it. Until now. A few weeks ago, I requested access to the sealed documents related to my 2005 case and was granted permission to view them. What I found helped me put together missing pieces of the puzzle. Though some mysteries remain, I now have enough clarity to finally step out of the shadow that I have lived in for so long. What I'm about to share is, without doubt, the single most difficult part of my story. But it is necessary not to hurt those involved, but to free myself from the unbearable burden of secrecy that I have carried since I was a young girl. I have sought resolution in the past, approaching the individual responsible for facilitating my abuse. My attempts were met with extreme hostility, with accusations against my mental health and my memory. Several years ago, after writing a letter detailing what I understood to have happened, I was told my accusations were unforgivable. I recognize now that these responses stemmed from not only a deep pain, but also the desperate hope that I would remain silent. When the dust settled, I found I wasn't ready to give this person up, and in order to smooth the troubled waters, I apologized for having brought it all up, and once again chose to bury it deep in my mind. Once again, I hoped it would just disappear, but that's simply not how trauma heals. Another very difficult truth for me to hold is that my father went to his grave still carrying the blame that Doug Wilson and others placed on him for, quote, allowing my abuse to occur, for, quote, failing to protect me. It is excruciating to think that my silence shielded those who were truly responsible. Up until the time of his death, my father still could not discuss what had happened to me without breaking down emotionally, overwhelmed by the pain of what I went through and the shame he held for not knowing or acting sooner. Many times he told me he wished he'd trusted his instincts early on, but he was in his own position of being manipulated, and he stayed quiet. The orchestration of what took place from the time I was 13 until I was nearly 16 years old was strategic and deliberate. It took physical form within weeks of our family relocating to Moscow, Idaho, from my childhood home in Lewiston. I remember that move feeling so surreal. We were moving to be closer to the Christ Church community we belonged to and to be closer to Boosers, the coffeehouse pub my parents had started with another church couple a few months earlier. I remember the day we officially left the Lewiston home and moved to our temporary home on Moscow Mountain. The boxes were loaded in the moving truck, and I stood looking at my empty room, the one I'd slept in since I was a baby, and felt a deep grief. As though a part of me was dying, I believe my spirit knew the chapter that came next, even if I couldn't begin to imagine it. Many of the details of the arrangement are still unclear to me, as the plans were often made behind my back. But one thing is unmistakable. My abuse at the hands of Jamin White, a seminary student nearly 10 years older than me, was carefully planned from the very beginning. My own mother played a pivotal role in facilitating this abuse. I may never fully understand why a mother could do this, why those in power protected her along with my abuser when it all came out, but I do know that my silence has cost me too much. From the very beginning, she orchestrated situations that put me and Jamin together, ensuring we had time alone. When my father was out of town for work, my mother would take us on trips, booking hotel rooms and encouraging Jamin and me to go to the pool together while she rested. She provided us alcohol on numerous occasions. She would make sure to inform both of us when she was running errands and my dad was out of the house. She made sure my dad was never around when these, quote, dates were planned. She kept him off the scent, knowing that he would have intervened if he knew what was actually happening. Though our house was full of college-aged boarders, Jamin was the only male allowed to live on the top floor, which my mother insisted on for reasons that were never clear to me, giving him easy and private access to my room through a shared bathroom. Even if my mom didn't know exactly what Jamin was putting me through behind closed doors, it's hard for me to imagine she did not understand the risk. Still, I can't say what she was telling herself. I only know how her actions allowed me to experience abuses for years that no child should know. And I know Jamin's abuse of me would likely not have been possible without her involvement. There were also conversations involving both of my parents, Jamin and me, where we discussed whether Jamin could wait for me until I was of marrying age and if we could call our relationship a courtship. I remember my dad being extremely uncomfortable during these conversations, insisting that Jamin and I could only be friends with no physical contact or time alone. In hindsight, I now believe these conversations were decoys, an attempt to placate my father, while my mother and Jamin made secondary arrangements behind his back. She and Jamin would go for drives together fairly frequently, often under the guise of discussing something important. I never knew the content of these conversations, but I do know they were part of the plan. When my mother routinely confronted me about whether Jamin and I had touched, I would admit to small things, holding hands, a hug, and she would call me deceptive and slutty. The emotional whiplash was unbearable. I remember passing out during a number of these confrontations, my body unable to handle the chaos of her words. I would come to on the floor with her assuring me that I was fine. I don't believe she ever told anyone about these fainting spells. My father grew increasingly suspicious as time went on, but every time he voiced his suspicions, my mother found ways to discredit him. She painted him as unstable and paranoid, and when I finally came out, she and Doug created a narrative that he had lost his mind. They even forced him to undergo a mental evaluation. The gaslighting was relentless, and in full transparency, he likely was losing his mind, but not without severe pressure. Dad was desperate to take us away from Moscow. He begged my mother to leave that toxic community with him for all our sakes, but she would not leave. Somehow, my mother came out a victim on the other side of the tsunami that obliterated our family. She chose to side with Doug Wilson and the church, who continued to protect her and cruelly blame my father for what had happened. I want to be clear that I do not share this out of a desire to hurt my mother, to seek revenge, or to assign blame. I have compassion for her, and I recognize even she may not fully understand why she did what she did. For years, I struggled to reconcile my love for her with the reality of her actions, but I have learned that there is a line between compassion and sacrificing my own well-being. I cannot carry this burden any longer, no matter how much I love her or want things to be different. I hope readers will find compassion for her as well. The reason I've stayed silent for so long is multi-layered, but woven in with everything else, is that I have been holding out hope that she would come to me in a spirit of recognition. The harm that was done to her earlier in life was never her fault, She went through so much, and those aren't my stories to tell, but I recognize women today are a product of generations upon generations of oppression, abuse, and voicelessness. My own journey has unfolded in large part because of hers, and I'm grateful to her in spite of the pain. I believe everything is purposeful, even if we can't understand why right now. My mother has been one of my greatest teachers in so many ways, and she holds a number of powerful traits and characteristics that make me proud to be her daughter in those respects. But this pain is too big to hold on my own, and thus far she has not been able to help me hold it or to explain why I'm holding it. My heart remains open to reconciliation and connection, to having the relationship with my mother I've always wanted but never experienced. I want to turn around and help her heal with all the tools I've gained along the way, but you cannot help someone who does not want to be helped, and up to this point, this has not been a pathway available to us. That was an excerpt from a recent Facebook post from childhood sexual abuse survivor Natalie Greenfield, who grew up in a Christchurch household in Moscow in which her mother facilitated her grooming that led to the abuse by a 24-year-old New St. Andrews College student who was boarding in her house when she was 14 years old and collaborated with Christchurch pastor Doug Wilson in dealing with the aftermath after it was found out. According to Greenfield, the judge in Jamin White's case gave him a light sentence and commented from the bench it was a teenage romance gone wrong. The post comes more than 8 years after Greenfield gave a speech to the Humanists of the Palouse at the 1912 Center in Moscow about the childhood sexual abuse that did not reveal about her mother's apparent involvement. Here's an excerpt from that talk.
And I want to take a little break here to talk a little bit about a part of the conservative Christian community that, in hindsight, I believe in a way kind of primed me for the abuse that would take place. And you've probably a lot of you have heard of like the purity culture. And if you haven't, I'll explain it. The purity culture is, it is the idea that any sexual activity of any place before marriage is unacceptable. And in Christchurch specifically, they promote courtship. And so what courtship is where the guy likes a girl, he's interested in a girl, that guy would go to the girl's father and express that interest and either receive or not receive permission to be able to get to know her better. And if he's given permission to get to know her better, then that would happen in group settings. The couple would never be alone together. There would be little to no physical affection allowed. So there's a real sense of accountability and nothing can kind of happen behind the scenes, right? So that was a big part of that culture. And there was also, it's a pretty patriarchal community. And that is the idea that men are the head of households and women are to submit to their husbands. And I think that there are certain situations where that can be a part of the way that, let's say, that a family operates. And maybe nothing goes wrong. Maybe it works very, very well for them and they're happy in that. And I'm not one to say that is, to each their own, right? But I do think that in general, patriarchal systems can be a real recipe for disaster. When you have a group of people that considers themselves to be above another group of people, I think that bad things can eventually end up happening. And that combined with the purity culture created a real sense of shame, especially for me as a girl. So I had a lot of shame about, my body, as my body was developing and that kind of thing. I didn't have any sex education or any real understanding of anything like that. And talking about any of that was really off limits, which any time you have something that's taboo and you know that it's not supposed to be talked about, it naturally establishes a sense of secrecy and kind of shame or embarrassment around that. And then it was also understood that if you were to engage in any sexual activity before marriage, even if you were engaged to someone, that was also a really shameful thing and very sinful and was obviously very, very frowned upon. And And so with the purity culture and the courtship culture and patriarchy and all of these things combined, I had a pretty clear sense of what my place as a girl was. And I knew that my dad was in charge of me, and I knew that my ultimate goal in life, though I could have interests and pursue those interests, my goals in life should be to be a wife and a mother someday, and to, you know, find a nice man to marry, and that man would ask my dad if he could get to know me and go through that whole process, and then I would, ownership of me would be passed from my father to this man, and that's how the rest of my life would go. And as a kid, it wasn't something that I was like, no, this is horrible, it's so unfair. Like, it was, you know, it was a part of my life. It was not, I wasn't going along with like a great sense of injustice or anything. It was the culture that I was raised in, and that was what I knew. It's what I was familiar with, so to me it was natural and normal and acceptable.
That was childhood sexual abuse survivor Natalie Greenfield speaking to the Humanists of the Palouse May 1st, 2016 at the 1912 Center in Moscow. The talk included the story of her relationship at age 14 with a 24-year-old New St. Andrews student who boarded with her family as she was growing up. Well, that's it for the KRFP Evening Report for tonight. Taking a look at the weather, mostly cloudy tonight, low 36, 30% chance of precipitation tomorrow in the form of rain, snow level 4,000 feet, cloudy, gradually becoming mostly sunny, high 47, southwest winds 10 to 15, gusts up to 25. 80% chance of rain Tuesday night, mainly after 10 p.m., snow level 4,400 feet, low 34. And 100% chance of rain Wednesday, snow level 4,900 feet, high 43. Southeast winds 10 to 15, gusts up to 25, between a quarter and a half inch of rain possible. If you want to help KRFP keep newscasts like this on the air, plus the newscasts you hear during Morning Mix, the recordings of local events and the public affairs shows, plus the music and arts programming you hear every day on KRFP, be sure to become a member of KRFP. Memberships are $35 a year, $20 for students and low income. You can mail your memberships to KRFP, 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho, 83843. Or you can go to the KRFP website to find out more ways to help KRFP. There's a drop-down box that says Support KRFP. You can adopt a DJ, you can underwrite, and there's a PayPal option and a Patreon button. I'm Lee Robartis. Have a good night. We'll be back tomorrow night with another evening report and also election night coverage. Stay tuned for more KRFP Moscow Pullman Community Radio for the Palouse.
Programming on KRFP is sponsored in part by C.F. Morrison Guitars at 130 North Grand Avenue in Pullman, providing lessons, repairs, and handmade acoustic and classical guitars. Open Wednesday and Saturday afternoons. Details at cfmorrisonguitars.com. KRFP thanks its donors and sponsors.